Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we begin a series. A series of programs, 1 to 2 hours every week, that will explore the pain, the power, the profit, and the politics about AIDS. It is my belief that at this time, 30 years plus post the beginning of the so-called AIDS epidemic, that we have only heard one side of the equation, the official version. There are more than 350,000 articles published in the peer-reviewed literature on AIDS. There are millions of individuals over these decades who have worked in AIDS research or in AIDS treatment or in foundations involving raising money for AIDS. The media has been uniform. It only promotes, discusses, or shares information that is officially sanctioned by a relatively small group of individuals who are very powerful. If at any time you have a position, irrespective of the research, the scholarship, the legitimacy of your challenge, if it in any way diminishes the public's view of the official story, you will be attacked. You'll be called an AIDS denialist. Now, those in the field who have found reason to challenge different aspects of the AIDS paradigm do not call those who support AIDS research and treatment truth deniers, but they could. Why? Because there are some outstanding scientists, including Nobel Prize winners that you're going to hear tonight, professors of virology, and the highest academic standing in a university that is an emeritus professor. There are over 3,000 such individuals, activists, researchers, medical doctors, journalists, who after taking their time and carefully examining the actual scientific literature have had questions. They believe that there should be a new appraisal of the subject of AIDS. This does not make them in denial of the 30-plus conditions we call AIDS. Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, wasting diseases, these are real. People have suffered and people have died from them. But the question is, were they all due to one single retrovirus? And there is where much of the argument lies. There are individuals who claim that it was never fully sequenced. There are individuals who believe that it was and that it plays a relatively small, minor role, that it's other factors that should be focused on, but these were never focused on, not because the science could not show they were causative, but because of the politics and the agenda behind the individuals and their groups. There's a lot of money riding on keeping everything as it is. Thus far, the most conservative figure I can find is over $440 billion. I've also found figures as high as $800 billion. In fact, more money being spent each year on AIDS, though it's not in the top killing diseases in the United States, than on cancer and heart disease combined, which are the top two killers. Today, we will begin with two of the individuals who worked for over 30 years helping people with AIDS-defining illnesses. Many of them had come from other groups, had been on medications, and were not doing well. They wanted an alternative approach. And so they worked with these individuals, and they were also a part of many of the original AIDS groups, and we'll hear about that. In fact, you'll hear on an upcoming program some of the leading journalists, including several gay journalists, John Lauritsen and Terry Michaels, who will tell you about gay-on-gay attacks, something the media has chosen not to discuss. You'll hear, in my opinion, from the greatest medical scientific journalist in the world. He was the medical and scientific editor for the Sunday Times of London, Neville Hodgkinson. You will hear from one of the outstanding researchers from around the world, David Crowe from Canada, Celia Farber from the United States, and Joan Shenton from England. You'll also hear from a multitude of scientists. This is the most definitive, original, in-depth investigative reporting discussion on AIDS that I can find anywhere in American or world history. I will be running this series 1 to 2 hours per week until it is complete. So at least those who want the truth will have it, and those who do not want to hear this information will not. It won't make a difference to them. Let's bring on first Michael Ellner. Dr. Michael Ellner is an internationally respected scholar in mind-body medicine. He's an expert in hypnosis, and he's a leader in warning people about the destructive consequences of unrecognized mental conditions. He is the president of HEAL, and HEAL is one of the more important groups in the United States. He has been with HEAL, the Health Education AIDS Liaison in New York City, which is the world's oldest and largest all-volunteer alternative AIDS information network, and which was started back in 1982, before the AIDS crisis occurred. HEAL was the first AIDS organization to challenge the automatic death sentence embedded in a positive AIDS diagnosis, and was a pioneer in offering alternative challenges to the official AIDS establishment. Michael has received honors as Educator of the Year by the International Medical and Dental Hypnotherapy Association and the National Guild of Hypnotherapists and National Federation of NLP. And you can find out more about Michael and his work at MYCAnxietyHypnosis.com. Joining Michael will be from New York City, Tom DiFernando. He is a pain injury and trauma therapist with nearly 30 years of experience. He was the executive director of HEAL New York from 1992 to 2013, working as an international speaker, an HIV counselor, a writer and editor, and director of HEAL's popular weekly cable television show, HEAL This Week. Tom has been a leader in the AIDS dissident movement that perceives AIDS as a social problem more so than a medical problem. He has also developed a counseling technique that centers on crisis mentality. And he is joining us in a moment as well. Nice to have you both with us. Let's begin with you, Michael.
Okay, so let me quickly make it very clear that Dr. Ellner is incomplete. It's actually Reverend Dr. Ellner. It's not an academic degree. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a psychologist. It's a religious degree, and it really isn't relevant to this conversation. I began as an activist in 1982 because I was aware of the serious consequences of telling people they had an automatic death sentence. And it occurred to me that it would even be more horrific if it weren't true. So I began to see if I could find long-term survivors and challenge the always fatal proclamation. I was able to find them, and they attended our anonymous and confidential HEAL meetings as living proof that it wasn't an automatic death sentence. So that was the first challenge I had to the official line, which was everywhere you turned, always fatal, always fatal, always fatal. HIV equals AIDS equals death. HIV equals AIDS equals death. And that's social programming to get sick and possibly die. So my first AIDS activism was challenging that. And then I made a lot of enemies in the AIDS, gay AIDS activist movement because the two central tenets of their activities needed to be challenged. The first real collaboration between politicians, government officials, and AIDS activists surrounded the idea that everyone was at risk for AIDS. And in the gay community, it was known as de-gaying AIDS. And they made a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week commitment to challenge anyone who would suggest that this was a gay problem. Now, in actuality, it was a problem for a subgroup of gay men. And by not focusing on them and their risks, and instead sexually terrorizing everybody by telling everyone everyone's at risk, I believe it proved to be very destructive, because all of the available resources for prevention were misdirected to people who weren't really at risk. So anyone who challenged this idea that everyone was at risk, and I was one of those people, became public enemy to the gay AIDS activists. The second place that I drew a lot of anger, concentrated hate, death threats, hospital confrontations, phone zaps, being labeled, you know, a menace to public health, as well as a denialist, was when I challenged the notion of drugs into bodies. And I was aware and continue to point out that it's well known desperate people make desperate decisions. And here you had a group of people who were desperate for some kind of treatment, and a pharmaceutical industry that not only funded them, but told them, hey, the only thing getting in the way between you're getting the treatments that might save your lives is the FDA, and having to prove the safety and effectiveness of these treatments. And by bypassing the safety and effectiveness requirements, it unleashed high-dose AZT, DDI, DTC3, and these drugs killed more people than AIDS. These high-dose early retrovirals were a horrific chapter in the history of AIDS, and anyone who protested, and I certainly was one of the more vocal protesters, along with John Morrison and Celia Farber and Peter Duisberg and Tom DiFernando, we got a lot of, let's say, stuff from gay AIDS activists. And those were the two main tenets. Now, prior to HEAL challenging treatments, we were the darling of the AIDS community. We were the only organization that offered alternative treatment information. And at that time, people were open to alternative treatments. But as soon as we began to question something as dangerous as prophylaxing against PCP pneumonia, and people were told to take pentamidine or Bactrim, aerosol pentamidine, IV Bactrim and stuff, and the study that was being used to recommend this actually showed that these people were dying at a much higher rate from AIDS-related problems that weren't PCP. And when I brought this to the attention of all the hotlines in New York City and the surrounding areas, we used to meet once a week. All hotlines would meet under the auspices of GMHC. And I bought a copy of the study for each of the organizations and made a case that this recommendation is dangerous and irresponsible. We were immediately deleted from the reference and the directories of all the AIDS organizations in New York. So we went to being very easy to find, to being completely invisible, because we challenged a popular treatment that proved to be a disaster, and no one would recommend it now.
Michael, let's look at a few of the statements you've made in more detail. When you state that you were one of the leading AIDS educational groups, give us some background of which groups were supporting you, opened up their offices or recommended people to your groups, and what were you sharing that they agreed with?
Well, we were sharing alternative information that they didn't have and weren't paying attention to. So at the time, we formed to offer an alternative to GMHC, which was the major organization. And early on, I volunteered to do something for GMHC. And in order to be a volunteer, you had to go through their orientation. And when we went through their orientation, my feeling was is that they were well-meaning, but they were promoting getting sick and dying. And I wanted to oppose that kind of support for people with AIDS. And the other groups were the People with AIDS Coalition, and we did a lot of different things with them, and they were very open to the idea that the people who utilized their services were interested in alternatives. And rather than recommending a particular type of alternative, what we did is provided informational resources about the variety of alternative treatments people were using. The other groups at that time were body positive. We were on their referral list. We often did talks for them that they sponsored. There was the group in Queens that also had us on all their referral lists. But this was primarily all the New York City hotlines. And I didn't really follow the individual hotlines. We were just part of all of their directories as a resource. And we were the only alternative resource. And we were removed from all of those lists. Tom was present at that meeting, so perhaps he can fill in some of the details as well.
Before we go to Tom, I have a few more issues I'd like for you to discuss.
Okay.
So if we understand the setting, there were multiple groups trying the best they could, or at least with the tools they had, to help people who were told that they had an HIV-positive diagnosis, hence they had AIDS, defining illnesses, and they needed to be helped. And
Can I interrupt, Barry?
Yes.
Barry, can I interrupt for a second?
Yes.
That's not true in the beginning. HEAL was providing these services before the claim of HIV. So our initial thing was directed at people who had been diagnosed with AIDS. And there were no people in the early meetings who were HIV positive because the testing didn't exist and no one even heard of an HIV at that time. And then by the time HIV was claimed to be the cause in 84 and widespread testing was rolled out in 85, we began to get 10, 15 people who tested positive but were otherwise healthy, and then, you know, one or two people with actual AIDS. So the dynamic changed in our group considerably when they introduced widespread HIV testing.
All right. But the point is that there were many different groups, each with their idea of how to help someone who had an AIDS-defining illness or had an immune-compromised system that in some way would adversely affect the person's health. You were the one, or HEAL was the group, that was focused upon natural alternative therapies rather than a traditional pharmaceutical or medical-based therapy. Is that correct?
Yes. And one of the things is these people were getting chemotherapies before AZT. The hallmark was KS, and people were given very aggressive chemotherapies to treat it. And our opinion, the people who came to our meetings who were survivors believed they were survivors because they didn't take those treatments. And so we were opposing treatments even before the introduction of high-dose AZT. Now, one of the things that I think should be talked about is these groups were well-meaning, but they were preparing people to die neatly, Gary.
Let us be clear here. Those people are not here to defend themselves, and all you can do is say that it is your opinion that that is what their motives were, because we don't know their absolute motives. Unless you have someone in front of you who says, this is my real motive for doing this, then all we can do is have our own personal opinions of that.
Well, my opinion is based on the orientations of the various groups. And they were preparing people, all right, we'll help you write a will. We'll help you do this. We'll help you leave all your money to GMHC so we can continue to fight. We'll help you leave all your money to ACT UP so you can continue the fight. The assumption was you weren't going to get out alive, but maybe you could help someone in the future. And that's true. It is my opinion, but it's a fact.
Okay.
That was the thrust of these groups.
All right. I'm sure, however, if they were here on this discussion, they would say that their point was to help people be as healthy as they could. And if we were told at that time AIDS was a death sentence, that was the message science was giving, that once you had these AIDS-defining illnesses, it was just a matter of time, and they wanted to, quote, put time on your side by taking the drugs, and hence the effort was to fast-track drugs through the FDA, not go through the laborious and expensive and years of testing, but rather have it done quickly, and that's how they got AZT through, by pressuring, demonstrations, lobbying, and speaking out. So from their perspective, I'm sure that many of them, if not most, were doing it in order to help the person, even if they had also gave them insights in that if you do pass, support the cause that continues forward. All those meetings weren't just about how to prepare to die. Because
well,
they
were about how to promote the idea everyone was at risk.
That's fine.
A uniform response to anyone who disagreed, especially anyone who disagreed publicly.
And what was that?
Well, we were denialists. That was not simply a group. That was most of the groups, if not all the groups, were actually gay AIDS organizations. Many disguised that by using names that didn't show that they were gay groups, but they were primarily all gay AIDS activists, and they primarily shared an agenda. Everybody's at risk, everybody's at risk, everybody's at risk, and anyone who challenges that, and anyone who would dare to suggest that some of those risks were behavioral, got the team ganging up on them. And I'm sure that all your guests will have experienced that.
Yes, they have, and as well as a lot more people that will not be appearing directly on the program, but have signed up with statements about what they consider the mismanagement of the war on AIDS. So hold your thoughts there. So let's go over for a moment, and I want to hear your perspective on this as well, Tom. Did you find that initially your input and your support, until you went against the pharmaceutical approach, that you were accepted?
Well, I was, how should I say this? Thank you for having us on the show, by the way. I made a conscious decision to kind of lay a little bit low, because I knew, when I was getting involved with this, the people like Michael and Celia and Joan and Peter Duesberg and all the rest of them were going to get hit hard, the more public they became. So while I was public, I was cautious and restrained in my publicness. I was leading meetings and I would speak to things, but I wasn't putting myself in a position to be as big a target as some of these other guys. So when I came in, there was these contentious questions were already there when I came in to heal. Michael started some years before me. So when I came in, things were already on fire. There was hysteria. With respect to what you were just saying a couple minutes ago, we have to kind of transport ourselves in time back to the early 80s, because in understanding AIDS, which, as you know, is it's really a complicated, crazy thing to sort out, and it takes time, but it does make sense once you really kind of sort it out. Back at that time, AIDS has gone through in the years, different stages. It's had a whole different manifestation socially and on a personal level for people. And in the early 80s, it was downright hysteria. I mean, we're not getting that like today. So you got to kind of transport back to what was kind of in the atmosphere and the spirit of that. And at the time, it really was like Michael's describing. I mean, it was, everybody was terrified that they were going to die. It was this sort of mass hysteria. It was assumed that you were going to die because so many of the people who were, the gay men in particular, who were very, very ill, these guys were deathly ill. I mean, you didn't need a virus to explain either what was going on. But that, you know, that was real, just like you said. Myself, when I was more public around some of the like ACT UP groups or even some of the people who were speaking at WBAI at the time, they definitely looked askance at me or would make critical remarks. But because I wasn't as big of a target, I didn't get the brunt of what some of these other folks did. I just tried to feed as much, you know, information and support I could in my own research on this question. I was especially interested in and was raising the issue of the social context for this because, for me, it was obvious the science was settled. The whole question of HIV was not a scientific issue. Even Peter Duisberg on his own basically put that to rest. The question for me was, that having been solved, why was HIV/AIDS persisting? Why was the hysteria persisting? You know, obviously there was something else going on. And we even held a few early conferences, but, you know, back in the early 90s with that intent, which was, in a way, they were almost too far ahead of the time. But the intent was to kind of do them even for history so that we would not be discussing does HIV cause AIDS or not, but that already, even back then, had been discussed, you know, completely thoroughly. The question is, you know, not whether or not HIV causes AIDS, but what is AIDS and why is there this need to marry oneself to this concept of an HIV? What function was it playing in this whole hysteria where there didn't need to be this hysteria? You know, there were health conditions that needed to be addressed, and when they were addressed, people got better. And they weren't addressed, they didn't get better. You know, there wasn't any real mystery there. But anyway, just back to your question. I personally didn't have people turn on me because I was never in as publicly a contentious position.
All right, let's go through a few of the things that in this long period of decades that you work with people with AIDS-defining illnesses and other immunosuppressed individuals.
Yes.
What did you learn? If you were to now, to this audience, which is a worldwide vast audience, what would you tell them is the total sum of your insight, your research? You've been in the battle on AIDS from nearly the beginning. And what are the lessons you've learned that you would like to share with us now?
That it's crucial that people reflect that there's a psychosocial component to this, and then to all illness, of course, you know, which you've talked about yourself many times. And to recognize that there is this process of simple unresolved conflicts in people's lives, internal tensions and frustrations that build up just in everyday life, where there's dissatisfaction in the mundane realms of life, in your relationships, in your work, in the kind of living circumstance you live under, that these things that look so mundane and uninteresting and kind of unsexy, you know, that these are the real things on which life and health and happiness are predicated. That when these things are not dealt with, and in many cases, because we live in what Wilhelm Reich called an armored society, we can talk about that more later, when you're living in an armored society, you don't address those real tensions. You instead look for other things to put the responsibility on. There's this thing you mentioned in my introduction that I call the crisis mentality. And it's this phenomenon, it's a lawful phenomenon that I feel helps explain why this hysteria took hold. You have a situation when people have these unresolved inner conflicts in the face of a crisis. Rather than deal with the crisis, they will and solve it, they will work to perpetuate it and escalate it to a point where it explodes, providing some substitute sense of satisfaction and gratification without addressing the real issues. The problem of that is that explosion is always destructive. The explosion is always in some sort of disease or accident or death or some sort of, you know, terrible thing that then everybody kind of shakes their head and go, oh, my God, you know, I knew that would happen. it's a crisis mentality. It's a compulsion. It's a way of grappling with these inner tensions without really knowing how to do it. They get triggered by some real crisis in front of you, and then that real crisis gets infested with all of life's tensions, and they piggyback on that modern day situation, blow it out of proportion, and then you just can't, you can't act rationally on it. So the big message here in all this is it's crucial to learn the psychodynamics of illness, the psychodynamics of human behavior, and that there's this distortion that happens in this process, particularly when you're raised in an authoritarian type society, you know, where children aren't allowed to love. They're not allowed to act on their natural capacity to love. And they grow up confused, and all the hatred and frustration that's generated in their, you know, in their childhood has to be directed outward to the other, you know, to either some other group of people or some other people with a different color or some other group with a different belief. Or other times, and this is the medical part and the part that was interesting to me in Heal, even projecting all those frustrations onto a virus, whether it's real or perceived. You know, it's like all responsibility for somebody's health and happiness is put on some entity outside of themselves, which absolves them of any real responsibility in sorting out what is it in their situation and then in their choices in life that have brought them to a condition of illness or you know, great dissatisfaction.
I appreciate those insights. No, that's all right. I appreciate it, Tom. We learned some perspective. Michael, I would like you to address the same thing. You were there before the AIDS epidemic or before the AIDS paradigm got underway, and you have been there for 35 years all told. So you've interfaced with tens of thousands of individuals in the weekly groups. Unlike a lot of people in the war on AIDS who have a state of mind, you actually were in there helping people make healthier choices and saw the results by a lot of people ending up surviving to this day. And therefore, you have a different perspective than those who may, with good intentions, I'm not challenging all their intentions, but they made wrong choices, in my opinion. AZT, DDI, DDC, some of the protease inhibitors, including the man who invented the protease inhibitors, who I've interviewed, said that in retrospect it was a mistake what was done with them. So on the one hand, you have people who are long-term survivors who got a more holistic and natural way of dealing with their illnesses. Other groups hope that the pill would do it for them. And unfortunately, most of those people died. And frequently when I would see people dying and talk with their partner, the worse the symptoms, the more the drug was given, as if it was the virus causing the symptoms, not the drug. As we would later learn from the Concord study and other studies, no, it was the drug. So give us your 35-year overview of what you've learned that could help people understand where we went wrong on the war on AIDS and what has to be done to correct that.
Well, I think the major error was assuming that testing HIV positive indicated one had a serious risk for developing AIDS. The fact is, early on, even when they were using chemotherapies before AIDS and the early introduction of AZT, these horrific chemotherapies sometimes had a benefit short term. And that was, as these people had multiple opportunistic infections, and these chemotherapies were the most powerful antibiotics on the planet. So in short-term use, they might have actually saved a life. Where people got in trouble is they never wanted you to stop using them. And then the longer-term use was killing people. So people were saying, Michael said, don't use medicine. I was trying to protect people who simply tested positive, who didn't have the well-known risks for developing AIDS, who were being bullied to take AZT before they got sick as a preventative. And the gay community prior to the introduction of AZT didn't support widespread HIV testing. And AZT was used by all the different groups to justify the push for widespread testing. And the reason the CDC was pushing for this is that these tests produce positive results in people with low risk. 9 out of 10 positive results are false positive when you test people at low risk, and they knew this. But it inflated the numbers, and the more people tested, the more people who will test falsely positive. So I thought that this widespread testing really had an extreme negative effect on people taking the test. And the claim that AZT was saving lives was baseless overall. I said there were some instances where it might have had a benefit, but by and large, most of the people taking it were taking it in a time frame where it suddenly was killing them. And that was a big mistake. I think drugs into bodies was understandable, but I felt that people didn't consider that most experimental drugs don't produce a benefit. And when you take a look at the research structure, signing up for all these different experimental drugs before they're approved is your right. But demanding access to them for anyone who wants them, I think that was a terrible and very serious mistake. Now, you raised a very important point, and I'll address that. And that is, we saw people who were diagnosed in 77, 78, 79. They preceded AIDS diagnosis as they were diagnosed with GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, and they were the first AIDS cases with the name change. So by the time I met these people, they were already survivors. And when I question them, I study people who do well. That's my hypnosis NLP background. I model successful people. And I wondered why all of them thought they were still alive. And it was these survivors who told me, well, part of it is I didn't take the treatments everybody else was taking. And these people, in terms of personality, when I got to spend some time with them, they wouldn't take an aspirin. They were anti-pharmaceuticals in life before they had health difficulties. And whatever they did to rebuild their health, it wasn't relying on conventional treatments. Now, we have seen a lot of people who have tested positive who do a wide variety of things, which seemed to be helpful. But if the assumption is they would have gotten AIDS if they didn't do something, I don't know if that's healthy. And Heal was suggesting that people really evaluate their health before deciding what to do. Most people testing positive that we met were otherwise healthy. They didn't have the well-known health risks for developing AIDS. And we didn't know why they tested positive, but we knew what it meant symbolically. And these people really, really, in a way, were psychologically harmed. And I'll tell you what happens. They're told they're positive, they're basically healthy, they stop eating, they stop sleeping. Many of them stop caring for themselves, shaving, bathing, they quit their jobs. And they keep expecting to wake up dead the next day. And even though they continue to not really have serious health problems, whatever unhealthy behaviors they had, they begin to increase them. If they're using drugs, they started using more drugs. If they were using alcohol, they started using more alcohol. If they were involved in unhealthy behaviors, they increased those unhealthy behaviors. So that knowing one's status was deleterious to their health. It had a serious negative impact because people reacted in a way that really promoted getting sick and dying. So that
I just
was,
like that. Oh, go on.
Go ahead,
just
Tom.
I wanted to add that Mike, thank you, Michael made an important contribution in the psychodynamics of this, and everything that he's describing right now, he gave it a name. He called it the aid zone. And this is a very clarifying concept that once people get into what we call the aid zone, we found that even then, as effective as alternative treatments are, used correctly, of course, as effective as they are, if somebody was still in the aid zone, it wasn't enough. They had to detoxify their thinking. They had to detoxify how they felt emotionally about this concept, HIV. If that didn't change, there was a depressiveness of something that held their energy down, that it didn't matter how much they detoxified or tried to rebuild themselves, they would keep going downhill.
I want to share some perspectives now to put this in a broader context. I was contacted by one of America's leading gay physicians, Dr. Stephen Chiesa, in the mid-1970s. He was seeing patients, gay patients, who he could not help. He was using antibiotic therapy. He was using an intravenous aqueous vitamin A to treat syphilis, but he did not know nutrition, so he asked, would I help him with? And I said, sure. So I began to counsel them, and in my counseling, I would ask about their lifestyle. And what I noticed was that almost all of them had very similar lifestyles. And the thing that was important was not the sex, but rather it was the lack of sleep, staying up late at night, night after night after night, not just occasionally. Taking massive amounts of antibiotics with the misbegotten notion that taking antibiotics would prevent a sexually transmitted disease. That doesn't work. Taking amyl nitrate so they could have multiple sexual events and partners, and the amyl nitrate or poppers could enhance the sexual climax. And also using other drugs as well. It was very common people tell me they were using heroin or cocaine. They were drinking and smoking. So when I would explain to them that any one of those could depress and does depress the immune system, and I would have scientific articles on each one. I had about 30 different articles from different peer-reviewed journals on poppers. I had articles on alcohol. I'd written a book on alcohol. I had articles on cigarette smoke, both direct and passive, on malnutrition, on antibiotic overuse, how it destroys the good bacteria and opens your gut up for massive overgrowth of bad bacteria. I also gave them studies showing unprotected anal intercourse and what would happen if the sensitive lining was ripped and semen injected into the anal canal, which could get into the bloodstream along with fecal matter. Also, I showed them what happens with sleep deprivation. You cannot make sleep up. When you miss it, it's gone. All of these individually are immunosuppressive and or create hyperimmune reaction. Together, they're deadly. And then on top of it, start taking, as Michael had suggested, start taking chemotherapy agents or strong pharmaceuticals. Now, there are times when strong pharmaceuticals can help break the free fall in a person's response, let's say, to a bacterial infections. Antibiotics could be life-saving then. And so what I did was to help them get their immune competence back, rebuild their intestinal flora with probiotics, get them to detoxify with juices and intravenous vitamin drips and various homeopathic zeolites and formulas, a full spectrum, and a good, healthy diet. And I did not tell them not to have sex because I didn't feel that was the problem. But I told them, realize you have unprotected sex. The way you're doing it, you can have hepatitis. And indeed, many of the people had hepatitis 2 or 3 times infection within a given year. So over the years, many years, and virtually 9 years before AIDS became official, I'd already worked with thousands of people. So when AIDS came along, what I noticed was, as Michael, you correctly said, it was the same illness. Now, here's what's interesting. There was at that time, and I didn't know it existed, I was invited, a vegetarian gay society. And they called and said, Gary, we're listening to your radio show. Would you come down and do a lecture? And I said, fine. So I lectured, and there were hundreds. It was packed of people. And I said, how many of you have tested positive for the HIV virus? All the hands went up. I said, how many tested positive for it? And only two hands went up. And I said, how many of you are drink, smoke, do drugs, amine nitrate? No hands went up. And I said, so the idea that you're being told that this is a gay disease, well, you're all gay and you're not disease. So therefore, it's not a disease of being gay. I believe it's a disease of lifestyle. And I gave them an example they weren't aware of. I had been helping people who were heterosexual couples, mainly swingers, who were using amine nitrate and going through the same lifestyle, identical to the fast-track gays. So then when I saw that only a tiny percent of gays were fast-tracked, meaning living this very hard fast-track life, they were the ones getting sick and primarily the ones being diagnosed as positive. The same was true with the heterosexuals, but no one, I mean no one, would pay attention to the fact you had a corresponding fast-track lifestyle with the same conditions in heterosexuals. Had that been done, the likelihood of calling this an AIDS epidemic, infecting everyone, would have stopped, because 90% of heterosexuals never participated in the sexual revolution and lived, in other words, relatively normal lifestyles, as did most gays. So that solved one big problem. And my second issue was to go into the gay community, go downtown with a group of people I'd met and who I'd worked getting their health back, where they introduced me to people who I interviewed. And over the next 5 years, I must have interviewed 2,000 people. I also, as you know, Michael, at the Tri-State Healing Center, I work with over 1,200 people every single day, 7 days a week, who had full-blown AIDS, giving them the same protocols. They would come in at 5 at night. And as you correctly stated, and I think it's important we emphasize this, Tom, we did not only work with people using detoxification, rejuvenation, cleansing, but a lot of emphasis was placed upon the psychological phenomena of getting over fear and not allowing de-stress to adversely affect these people, hence the idea of a positive support group, as did HEAL have a positive support group. As a result, we had such long-term healthy survivors. We had 12 people completely reverse their AIDS-defining condition, including going from HIV negative to HIV positive, HIV negative. We held a press conference on it. I don't know if you attended that press conference, Michael. But it was a big deal. We also had the biggest conference on alternative natural ways of treating AIDS at the church on Center Park West, which lasted almost 9 hours. And we had people from all over the world came, including someone from China and Japan with their herbal therapies. And the media never touched either of these, though they were invited. But many people within the gay community did, many gay activists did, and a lot of people who were interested in the subject of AIDS did. So then I started to see that this was not just about a virus, whether you believed in the virus or not. We saw that the average American was not at risk of AIDS, not then, not now. There has been no epidemic of AIDS in the general population, period. And also, well, it's sexually transmitted. Well, there's a problem with that, because the largest group tested were porn workers who every day are engaged in sexual activity. And there was no AIDS in that community, and they're tested weekly. So, also people would end up dying of what was called idiopathic origins, of unknown origins. They would die of AIDS, they were said. They couldn't find any HIV in their body. Well, how do you die of a condition where there's none of the virus you claim is the single and only necessary cause? Therefore, you start looking for other causes. But the one thing they all did have, they were taking the drugs, including AZT. So in front of everyone was this spectacle of bad science, of faulty public health, of activists who were either well-intentioned, but applying what I consider personally, my personal opinion, wrong insight. And as a result, not willing to take the responsibility and know up the fact that the people who were attacking everyone else for suggesting natural non-toxic approaches as AIDS denialists, no one was denying AIDS. Everybody was fully aware AIDS-defining illnesses existed. But those people were suggesting and demanding drugs, 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 and so they won. The trouble is there was a long group of a list of people who died or suffered because of that. So that was my own personal experience. Now, there was another thing that no one's talked about, and we're going to play this right now. We're going to play a clip from the man who won, unshared, won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV virus, Luc Monsignor. This is a clip from a documentary that I highly recommend that is now posted on our website, along with dozens of articles, over a dozen different documentaries, including House of Numbers, of people, including a list of AIDS dissidents, including Nobel Prize winners and professors of virology, who say the war on AIDS has to be redefined, we have to reexamine it. They're not denying AIDS, they're not denying suffering, they're not denying people are sick. They are challenging the monotheistic mindset. Here's what he had to say, and had this gotten out into the mainstream media, had this been broadcast, then the entire AIDS paradigm would have collapsed. The pharmaceutical paradigm would have collapsed. Listen carefully to what he says. You can actually prevent AIDS from HIV from being infected if you're healthy and take antioxidants, or you can get it out of the body. No medicine, just antioxidants, water. Listen to what he has to say. This is the most important man in the entire war on AIDS, and no one is paying attention to what he just said. Listen up.
You talked about oxidative stress earlier. Is treating oxidative stress one of the best ways to deal with the African AIDS epidemic?
I think this is one way to approach, to decrease the rate of transmission, because I believe HIV, we can be exposed to HIV many times without being chronically infected. Our immune system could get rid of the virus within a few weeks if you have a good immune system. And this is the problem also of African people. Their nutrition is not very equilibrated. They are in oxidative stress, even they are not infected with HIV. So their immune system doesn't work well already. So it's prone, it can, you know, allow HIV to get in and persist. So there are many ways which are not the vaccine, the magic name, the vaccine. Many ways to decrease the transmission just by simple measures of nutrition, giving antioxidants, proper antioxidants, hygiene measures, fighting the other infections. So they are not spectacular, but they could, you know, decrease very well the epidemic to the level they are in occidental countries,
so
Western countries.
If you have a good immune system, then your body can naturally get rid of HIV.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Do you think we should have more of a push for antioxidants and things of that nature in Africa than antiretrovirals?
We should push for more, a combination of measures, antioxidant by nutrition, advice and nutrition, fighting other infections, malaria, tuberculosis, parasitosis. Most children have worms. Education, of course, genital hygiene for women and men also. Very simple measure, which is not very expensive, but which could do a lot. And this is my worry about, the many spectacular actions. Of course, there are global funds to buy drugs and so on, Bill Gates and so on, for the vaccine. But, those kind of measures are not very well funded, not funded at all, or they are, it really depends on the local government to take conscious of this, but the local government, they take advice of the scientific advisors from the surgeon institutions, and they don't get this kind of advice very often.
There's no money in nutrition, right? There's no profit.
There's no profit, yes. The water is important. Water is key.
Now, one thing you said, you were talking about the fact that if you have a built immune system, it is possible to get rid of HIV naturally. If you take a poor African who's been infected and you build up their immune system, is it possible for them to also naturally get rid of it?
I would think so.
Okay. That's an important
It's
point.
Important knowledge, which is completely neglected. People always think of drugs and vaccine. So this is a message which may be different from what you heard before, no?
The closing?
No, my message is different from what you heard from Fauci.
Yes.
All right, here is he saying, you heard from Fauci and all drugs, drugs, drugs. Here is the Nobel Prize winner. Here is the man who discovered the HIV virus. Here is the man that the entire, 100% of the entire AIDS paradigm was based upon his work, not Gallo's. And he's saying, clean water, good nutrition, antioxidants, and you can get rid of HIV in the body. Well, there goes the pharmaceutical industry. There goes $800 billion. He's not up on the vaccines. There have been 67 vaccine trials. All have failed. There's been all these drugs. They've had all the money in the world. They have failed. And that's why there are 3,000 scientists, activists, and journalists, and physicians who are now looking at the evidence and saying, we have been on the wrong path here. And yet no one outside of this audience and those who watched House of Numbers even know that he had this to say. Final comments, Michael Elner?
Well, you know, I hosted Luc Montagné. I met him in Amsterdam, and he actually made a public statement where he questioned the role of HIV and AIDS and made the comment that he felt that there were many, many cofactors or alternative theories that warranted attention. And at the time, a Pentagon researcher, Xiqing Luo, had put forth a theory that mycoplasma might be accounting for why people are getting sick. And Xiqing Luo and Montagné did a presentation for HEAL in New York City. And Montagné made it very, very clear he was against the death sentence that was automatically given to people. And he was very, very open to the idea that all of the lifestyle issues that you mentioned were important contributors to why people were getting sick. So okay. His formula was HIV plus all these other things equal AIDS. Tom and I took the position, well, if you have all these other things, do you really need an HIV? So Luc Montagné had the courage to challenge the death sentence. He had the conviction to mention all the lifestyle issues that contributed to getting sick. And in Africa, the lifestyle issue was being extremely poor. No sanitation, polluted water, poor nutrition, if any nutrition. These people were starving. So he made substantial contributions that were ignored, and that's unfortunate.
Okay. Tom, final statement, please.
Yes. Yes. Just to reinforce what the last 15 minutes or so have been about for your audience, who, for those who are hearing, you know, HIV does not cause AIDS, that argument for the first time, that the whole point here is if AIDS isn't caused by HIV, what's it called? Caused by, it's health risks. There are real health risks that nobody's denying, that if you address health risks, you can recover your health. Second, another thing I want to mention very briefly is that the point of view of HEAL, when we started, it was never something that we, it was not preconceived. We didn't go in and impose a view on people. We simply observed what was happening by the thousands of people who came through our meetings and then just reflected it back to them. And the last thing I want to mention is that earlier when I was mentioning the roles of lack of satisfaction in people's lives and the relationship between that and you know, health and illness, was that that's not a blame the victim statement. The crucial thing here is we were never interested in people who were acting on bad information. We were particularly interested in the people who, even given the correct information, would still be drawn into the bad information. What function was that serving in their lives? To insist that the destructive view, the view that disempowered you, the view that said there was really no hope, why was that more attractive to them than the idea that, in fact, they have a direct impact on the outcome of their situations in life at all times?
And Tom and Michael, there's one very important aspect here, and that is the shameful, shameful fraudulent science of the HIV antibody test. You're given a vaccine to create an antibody that then is supposed to be protective. With HIV, if you have the antibody, because they're not actually searching for the virus, but the antibody, you're supposed then to die from the virus. That's science upside down. Also, if you have an antibody test, it must be specific only for what you're testing. But with HIV, if you took a flu shot, you could test positive. If you had the measles, positive. Pregnancy, positive. Tuberculosis that he mentioned, positive. Leprosy, positive. Malaria, positive. and hepatitis positive, herpes positive, mycoplasma positive. Over 67 different conditions could give you a false positive, and yet you didn't have to have the HIV virus to get this positive. And then when you were told you were positive, think of the people that committed suicide. Think of the people that psychologically felt that they had just been given a death sentence and would allow themselves, as Tom said earlier, to go into this deep depression and start to be very, very counter health in their life choices. So there is no accurate antibody test yet. There's hundreds of millions of dollars made because every antibody test that someone takes, someone gets a royalty on. Gee whiz, did you ever look to see who owns the royalty on the number one test that was given and how much money they've made? And therefore, they have a reason to tell you, oh, get the antibody test and look at all the drugs and look at the drug money that went to different groups and individuals as long as they kept the paradigm alive. So that brings us to the conclusion of the first part of our in-depth original investigative reporting series. We're going to take a 30-second break and come back with Dr. Peter Duesberg, the doctor who was vilified because he told the truth, and Nobel Prize winner of the PCR, Dr. Kerry Mullis, who is one of the most intelligent, articulate, outspoken persons on this subject. Back in a moment.